Random House Audio presents Sycamore Row by John Grisham. Read for you by Michael Beck. Chapter 1. They found Seth Hubbard in the general area where he had promised to be, though not exactly in the condition expected. He was at the end of a rope, 6 feet off the ground and twisting slightly in the wind. A front was moving through, and Seth was soaked when they found him. Not that it mattered. Someone would point out that there was no mud on his shoes and no tracks below him, so therefore he was probably hanging and dead when the rain began. Why was that important? Ultimately, it was not. The logistics of hanging oneself from a tree are not that simple. Evidently, Seth thought of everything. The rope was 3/4-inch braided natural manila, of some age and easily strong enough to handle Seth, who weighed 160 pounds a month earlier at the doctor's office. Later, an employee in one of Seth's factories would report that he had seen his boss cut the 50-foot length from a spool a week before using it in such dramatic fashion. One end was tied firmly to a lower branch of the same tree and secured with a slapdash mix of knots and lashings. But they held. The other end was looped over a higher branch, 2 feet in girth, and exactly 21 feet from the ground. From there it fell about 9 feet, culminating in a perfect hangman's knot, one that Seth had undoubtedly worked on for some time. The noose was straight from the textbook, with 13 coils designed to collapse the loop under pressure. A true hangman's knot snaps the neck, making death quicker and less painful. And apparently, Seth had done his homework. Other than what was obvious, there was no sign of a struggle or suffering. A 6-foot step ladder had been kicked aside and was lying benignly nearby. Seth had picked his tree, flung his rope, tied it off, climbed the ladder, adjusted the noose, and when everything was just right, kicked the ladder and fell. His hands were free and dangling near his pockets. Had there been an instant of doubt, of second guessing, when his feet left the safety of the ladder, but with his hands still free, had Seth instinctively grabbed the rope above his head and fought desperately until he surrendered? No one would ever know. But it looked doubtful. Later evidence would reveal that Seth had been a man on a mission. For the occasion, he had selected his finest suit, a thick wool blend, dark gray, and usually reserved for funerals in cooler weather. He owned only 3. A proper hanging has the effect of stretching the body so Seth's trouser cuffs stopped at his ankles and his jacket stopped at his waist. His black wingtips were polished and spotless. His blue necktie was perfectly knotted. His white shirt, though, was stained with blood that had oozed from under the rope. Within hours, it would be known that Seth Hubbard had attended the 11 a.m. worship service at a nearby church. He had spoken to acquaintances, joked with a deacon, placed an offering in the plate, and seemed in reasonably good spirits. Most folks knew Seth was battling lung cancer, though virtually no one knew the doctors had given him a short time to live. Seth was on several prayer lists at the church. However, he carried the stigma of 2 divorces and would always be tainted as a true Christian. His suicide would not help matters. The tree was an ancient sycamore Seth and his family had owned for many years. The land around it was thick with hardwoods, valuable timber Seth had mortgaged repeatedly and parlayed into wealth. His father had acquired the land by dubious means back in the 1930s. Both of Seth's ex-wives had tried valiantly to take the land in the divorce wars, but he held on. They got virtually everything else. First on the scene was Calvin Boggs, a handyman and farm laborer Seth had employed for several years. Early Sunday morning, Calvin had received a call from his boss. "Meet me at the bridge at 2 p.m., Seth said. He didn't explain anything, and Calvin was not one to ask questions. If Mr. Hubbard said to meet him somewhere at a certain time, then he would be there. At the last minute, Calvin's 10-year-old boy begged to tag along, and against his instincts, Calvin said yes. They followed a gravel road that zigzagged for miles through the Hubbard property. As Calvin drove, he was certainly curious about the meeting. He could not remember another occasion when he met his boss anywhere on a Sunday afternoon. He knew his boss was ill, and there were rumors he was dying, but like everything else, Mr. Hubbard kept it quiet. The bridge was nothing more than a wooden platform spanning a nameless, narrow creek choked with kudzu and crawling with cottonmouths. For months, Mr. Hubbard had been planning to replace it with a large concrete culvert, but his bad health had sidetracked him. It was near a clearing where two dilapidated shacks rotted in the brush and overgrowth, and offered the only hint that there was once a small settlement there. Parked near the bridge was Mr. Hubbard's late-model Cadillac, its driver's door open along with the trunk. Calvin rolled to a stop behind the car and stared at the open trunk and door and felt the first hint that something might be out of place. The rain was steady now, and the wind had picked up, and there was no good reason for Mr. Hubbard to leave his door and trunk open. Calvin told his boy to stay in the truck, then slowly walked around the car without touching it. There was no sign of his boss. Calvin took a deep breath, wiped moisture from his face, and looked at the landscape. Beyond the clearing, maybe 100 yards away, he saw a body hanging from a tree. He returned to his truck, again told the boy to stay inside and keep the doors locked. But it was too late. The boy was staring at the sycamore in the distance.
"Stay here now," Calvin said sternly, "and don't get out of the truck."
"Yes, sir."
Calvin began walking. He took his time as his boots slipped in the mud and his mind tried to stay calm. What was the hurry? The closer he got, the clearer things became. The man in the dark suit at the end of the rope was quite dead. Calvin finally recognized him, and he saw the stepladder, and he quickly put the scene and the events in order. Touching nothing, he backed away and returned to his truck. It was October of 1988, and car phones had finally arrived in rural Mississippi. At Mr. Hubbard's insistence, Calvin had one installed in his truck. He called the Ford County Sheriff's Office, gave a brief report, and began waiting. Warmed by the heater and soothed by Merle Haggard on the radio, Calvin gazed through the windshield, ignored the boy, tapped his fingers along with the wipers, and realized he was crying. The boy was afraid to speak. Two deputies arrived in the same car half an hour later, and as they were putting on rain slickers, an ambulance arrived with a crew of three. From the gravel road, they all strained to see the old sycamore, but after a few seconds of focusing, it was apparent there was a man hanging from it. Calvin told them everything he knew. The deputies decided it was best to proceed as if a crime had been committed, and they prohibited the ambulance crew from approaching the scene. Another deputy arrived, then another. They searched the car and found nothing helpful. They photographed and videoed Seth hanging with his eyes closed and his head twisted grotesquely to his right. They studied the tracks around the sycamore and found no evidence of anyone else being present. One deputy took Calvin to Mr. Hubbard's home a few miles away. The boy rode in the back seat, still mute. The doors were unlocked, and on the kitchen table they found a note on a yellow legal pad. Seth had printed neatly. To Calvin, please inform the authorities I've taken my own life, with no help from anyone. On the attached sheet of paper, I have left specific instructions for my funeral and burial. No autopsy. S.H. It was dated that day, Sunday, October 2nd, 1988. Calvin was finally released by the deputies. He hustled the boy home, where he collapsed in his mother's arms and said nothing the rest of the day. Ozzie Walls was one of two black sheriffs in Mississippi. The other had just recently been elected from a county in the Delta that was 70% black. Ford County was 74% white. But Ozzie had won his election and re-election by wide margins. The blacks adored him because he was one of their own. The whites respected him because he was a tough cop and a former football star at Clanton High. In some aspects of life in the Deep South, football was slowly transcending race. Ozzie was leaving church with his wife and four kids when he got the call. He arrived at the bridge in a suit, no gun or badge, but he did have a pair of old boots in the trunk. Escorted by two of his deputies, he made the walk down to the sycamore in the mud and under an umbrella. Seth's body was by now soaked, and water dripped from the tips of his shoes, his chin, ears, fingertips, and the cuffs of his pants. Ozzie stopped not far from the shoes, raised his umbrella, and looked at the pallid, pathetic face of a man he'd met only twice. There was a history. In 1983, when Ozzie first ran for sheriff, he had three white opponents and no money. He received a call from Seth Hubbard, a stranger to him, and as Ozzie would learn, a man who kept a low profile. Seth lived in the northeast corner of Ford County, almost on the line with Tyler County. He said he was in the lumber and timber business, owned some sawmills in Alabama, a factory here and there, and gave the appearance of a man who was successful. He offered to bankroll Ozzie's campaign, but only if he would accept cash. $25,000 in cash. In his office, behind a locked door, Seth Hubbard opened a box and showed Ozzie the money. Ozzie explained that campaign contributions must be reported and so on. Seth explained that he did not want his particular contribution to be reported. He wanted a cash deal or no deal.
What do you want in return? Ozzie had asked.
I want you to be elected. Nothing more, Seth had replied.
I'm not so sure about this.
Do you think your opponents are taking cash under the table?
Probably.
Of course they are. Don't be foolish.
Ozzie took the money. He ramped up his campaign, squeaked into the runoff, then stomped his opponent in the general election. Later, he had stopped by Seth's office on two occasions to say hello and thanks, but Mr. Hubbard was never there. Mr. Hubbard did not return phone calls. Ozzie quietly quizzed others for information about Mr. Hubbard, but little was known. He was rumored to have made money in furniture, but no one knew for sure. He owned 200 acres of land near his home. He did not use local banks or law firms or insurance agencies. He went to church occasionally. 4 years later, Ozzie faced light opposition, but Seth wanted to meet anyway. $25,000 changed hands again, and again Seth disappeared from view. Now he was dead, killed by his own noose and dripping with rainwater. Finn Plunkett, the county coroner, finally arrived. The death could now be made official.
Let's get him down, Ozzie said.
The knots were untied, and with slack in the rope, Seth's body made its descent. They placed him on a stretcher and covered him with a thermal sheet. Four men labored under the strain as they made their way to the ambulance. Ozzie followed the little procession, as confused as anyone. He was well into his fifth year on the job, and he had seen so many dead bodies. Accidents, car wrecks, a few murders, some suicides. He wasn't callous, and he wasn't jaded. He had made the late-night phone calls to parents and spouses, and he always feared the next one. Good old Seth. Who exactly was Ozzy supposed to call now? He knew Seth was divorced, but did not know if he had remarried. He knew nothing about his family. Seth was about 70. If he had adult children, where were they? Oh, well. Ozzy would find out soon enough. Driving toward Clanton with the ambulance behind him, he began calling people who might know something about Seth Hubbard. Chapter 2. Jake Brigance stared at the bright red numbers of his digital alarm clock. At 5:29, he reached over, pushed a button, and gently swung his feet out of bed. Carla flipped from one side to the other and burrowed deeper under the covers. Jake patted her rear end and said good morning. There was no response. It was Monday, a work day, and she would sleep for another hour before scurrying from bed and hustling off to school with Hannah. In the summer, Carla would sleep even later, and her days were filled with girl stuff and whatever Hannah wanted to do. Jake, though, had a schedule that rarely varied. Up at 5:30, at the coffee shop by 6, at the office before 7. Few people attack the morning like Jake Brigance, though now that he had reached the mature age of 35, he asked himself more often why exactly did he awaken so early? And why did he insist on arriving at his office before all other lawyers in Clanton? The answers, once so clear, were becoming more obscure. His dream since law school of being a great trial lawyer was not diminished at all. Indeed, he was as ambitious as ever. Reality was bugging him. 10 years in the trenches, and his office was still filled with wills and deeds and two-bit contract disputes, not one decent criminal case, and no promising car wrecks. His most glorious moment had come and gone. The acquittal of Carl Lee Haley was 3 years ago, and Jake sometimes feared he was now beyond his pinnacle. As always, though, he brushed those doubts aside and reminded himself that he was only 35. He was a gladiator with many great courtroom victories before him. There was no dog to turn out, because they had lost their dog. Max died in the fire that destroyed their beautiful and beloved and heavily mortgaged Victorian home on Adams Street 3 years ago. The Klan had torched the house in the heat of the Haley trial, July 1985. First they burned a cross in the front yard, then they tried to blow up the house. Jake sent Carla and Hannah away, and it was a wise thing to do. After the Klan tried to kill him for a month, they finally burned down his house. He had given his closing argument in a borrowed suit. The topic of a new dog was too uncomfortable to fully address. They had danced around it a few times, then moved on. Hannah wanted one, and probably needed one, because she was an only child and often claimed to be bored playing alone. But Jake, and especially Carla, knew who would assume the responsibility of housebreaking and cleaning up after a puppy. Besides, they were living in a rental home, with their lives far from settled. Perhaps a dog could bring about some normalcy. Perhaps not. Jake often pondered this issue in the early minutes of the day. The truth was, he really missed a dog. After a quick shower, Jake dressed in a small spare bedroom he and Carla used as a closet to store their clothes. All rooms were small in this flimsy house owned by someone else. Everything was temporary. The furniture was a sad ensemble of giveaways and flea market leftovers, all of which would be tossed one day if things went as planned. Though Jake hated to admit, almost nothing was going his way. Their lawsuit against the insurance company was bogged down in pretrial maneuvering that seemed hopeless. He had filed it 6 months after the Haley verdict, when he was on top of the world and bristling with confidence. How dare an insurance company try and screw him? Show him another jury in Ford County, and he'd deliver another great verdict. But the swagger and bluster faded as Jake and Carla slowly realized they had been seriously underinsured. Four blocks away, their vacant and scarred lot was just sitting there, gathering leaves. From next door, Mrs. Pickle kept an eye on it, but there was little to watch. The neighbors were waiting for a fine new home to rise up and for the Braganzas to return. Jake tiptoed into Hannah's room, kissed her on the cheek, and pulled the sheets up a bit higher. She was seven now, their only child, and there would be no others. She was in the second grade at Clanton Elementary, in a classroom around the corner from where her mother taught kindergartners. In the narrow kitchen, Jake pushed a button on the coffee brewer and watched the machine until it began making noises. He opened his briefcase, touched the 9mm semi-automatic pistol holstered inside, and stuffed in some files. He had grown accustomed to carrying a gun, and this saddened him. How could he live a normal life with a weapon nearby at all times? Normal or not, the gun was a necessity. They burn your house after they try to bomb it. They threaten your wife on the phone. They torch a cross in your front yard. They beat your secretary's husband senseless, and he later dies. They use a sniper to take a shot, but he misses you and hits a guard. They wage terror during the trial and keep up their threats long after it's over. Four of the terrorists were now serving prison sentences, three federal, one at Parchman. Only four? Jake reminded himself constantly. There should have been a dozen convictions by now, a feeling shared by Ozzie and other black leaders in the county. Out of habit and out of a sense of frustration, Jake called the FBI at least once a week for updates on their investigation. After 3 years, his calls were often not returned. He wrote letters. His file filled an entire cabinet in his office. Only four. He knew the names of many others, all suspects still, in Jake's mind anyway. Some had moved and some had stayed, but they were out there, going about their lives as if nothing had happened. So he carried a gun, one with all the proper permits and such. There was one in his briefcase, one in his car, a couple around the office, and several others. His hunting rifles had gone up in the fire, but Jake was slowly rebuilding his collection. He stepped outside onto the small brick porch and filled his lungs with the cool air. On the street directly in front of the house, there was a Ford County Sheriff's patrol car, and behind the wheel sat one Lewis Tuck, a full-time deputy who worked the graveyard shift and whose primary responsibility was to be seen in the neighborhood throughout the night and specifically to be parked near the mailbox at precisely 5:45 each morning, Monday through Saturday, when Mr. Brigant stepped onto the porch and waved hello. Tuck waved back. The Braganzas had survived another night. As long as Ozzie Walls was sheriff of Ford County, which would be at least 3 more years, and probably much longer, he and his office would do whatever possible to protect Jake and his family. Jake had taken Carl Lee Haley's case, worked like a dog for peanuts, dodged bullets, ignored real threats, and lost almost everything before delivering a not guilty verdict that still resonated in Ford County. Protecting him was Ozzie's highest priority. Tuck eased away. He would circle the block and return in a few minutes after Jake left. He would watch the house until he saw lights in the kitchen and knew Carla was up and moving around. Jake drove one of two Saabs in Ford County, a red one with 190,000 miles on it. He needed an upgrade, but couldn't afford one.
Such an exotic car in a small town had once been a cool idea, but now the repair costs were brutal. The nearest dealer was in Memphis, an hour away, so every trip to the shop killed half a day and cost $1,000. Jake was ready for an American model, and he thought about this every morning when he turned the ignition key and held his breath as the engine rolled over and came to life. The engine had never failed to start, but in the past few weeks, Jake had noticed a delay, an extra turn or two that evoked an ominous warning that something bad was about to happen. Paranoid, he was noticing other noises and rattles, and he was checking the tires every other day as the treads grew thinner. He backed onto Culbert Street, which, though only four blocks from Adams Street and their vacant lot, was clearly in a lesser part of town. The house next door was also a rental. Adams was lined with homes much older and statelier and with more character. Culbert was a hodgepodge of suburban-style boxes thrown up before the city got serious about zoning. Though she said little, Jake knew Carla was ready to move on to somewhere. They had actually talked of moving away, of leaving Clanton altogether. The 3 years since the Haley trial had been far less prosperous than they had hoped and expected. If Jake was destined to slog through a long career as a struggling lawyer, then why not struggle somewhere else? Carla could teach school anywhere. Surely they could find a good life that did not include weapons and constant vigilance. Jake may have been revered by the blacks in Ford County, but he was still resented by many of the whites, and the crazies were still out there. On the other hand, there was a certain safety living in the midst of so many friends. Their neighbors watched the traffic, and a strange car or truck was noted. Every cop in town and every deputy in the county knew the safety of the Little Brigance family was of the highest importance. Jake and Carla would never leave, though it was sometimes amusing to play the old game of where would you like to live? It was only a game, because Jake knew the brutal truth that he would never fit in a big firm in a big city, nor would he ever find a small town in any state that was not already brimming with hungry lawyers. He was looking clearly at his future, and he was okay with it. He just needed to make a buck. He drove past the empty lot on Adams, mumbled vile words in condemnation of the cowards who torched his home, and managed a few choice ones for the insurance company as well, then sped away. From Adams he turned onto Jefferson, then Washington, which ran east and west along the north side of the Clanton Square. His office was on Washington, across from the stately courthouse, and he parked in the same spot each morning at 6 a.m. because at that hour there were plenty to choose from. The square would be quiet for 2 more hours until the courthouse and the shops and offices around it opened for business. The coffee shop, though, was bustling with blue collars, farmers, and deputies when Jake strolled in and began saying good morning. As always, he was the only one wearing a coat and tie. The white collars gathered an hour later across the square at the tea shop and discussed interest rates and world politics. At the coffee shop, they talked football, local politics, and bass fishing. Jake was one of the very few professionals tolerated inside the coffee shop. There were several reasons for this. He was well-liked, thick-skinned, and good-natured, and he was always available for a quick legal tip at no charge when one of the mechanics or truck drivers was in a bind. He hung his jacket on the wall and found a seat at a table with Marshall Prather, a deputy. 2 days earlier, Ole Miss had lost to Georgia by 3 touchdowns, and this was the hot topic. A gum-smacking, sassy gal named Dell poured his coffee while managing to bump him with her ample ass. The same routine 6 mornings a week. Within minutes, she delivered food he never ordered. Wheat toast, grits, and strawberry jelly. The usual. As Jake was shaking Tabasco sauce on the grits, Prather asked,
Say, Jake, did you know Seth Hubbard?
Never met him, Jake said, catching a few glances. I've heard his name once or twice. Had a place up near Palmyra, didn't he? That's it, Prather chewed on a sausage as Jake sipped his coffee. Jake waited, then said, I guess it's safe to assume something bad happened to Seth Hubbard because you put him in the past tense.
I did what? Prather asked.
The deputy had an annoying habit of dropping a loud, loaded question over breakfast and following it up with silence. He knew the details in the dirt, and he was always fishing to see if anyone else had something to add. The past tense. You ask, did I know him, not do I know him? Which would, of course, indicate he's still alive, right?
I suppose.
So what happened? Andy Furr, a mechanic at the Chevrolet place, said loudly,
Killed himself, yes, did he? Found him hanging from a tree.
Left a note and everything, added Dell as she swooped by with a coffee pot. The cafe had been open for an hour, so there was little doubt Dell knew as much about Seth Hubbard's passing as anyone.
Okay, what did the note say? Jake asked calmly.
Can't tell you, sweetie, she chirped. That's between me and Seth.
You didn't know Seth, Prather said.
Dell was an old tart with the quickest tongue in town. She said,
I loved Seth once, or maybe it was twice. Can't always remember.
There have been so many, Prather said.
Yeah, but you'll never get close, old boy, she said.
You really don't remember, do you?
Prather shot back and got a few laughs. Where was the note? Jake asked, trying to reverse the conversation. Prather stuffed a load of pancakes in his mouth, chewed for a while, then replied.
On the kitchen table. Ozzie's got it now, still investigating, but not much to it. Looks like Hubbard went to church, seemed fine, then drove back onto his property, took a stepladder and a rope, and did the deed. One of his workers found him around 2 yesterday afternoon, swinging in the rain, all dressed up in his Sunday best.
Interesting. Bizarre. Tragic. But Jake found it difficult to have any concern for a man he had never met. Andy Furr asked,
Did he have anything?
Don't know, Prather said. I think Ozzie knew him, but he's not saying much.
Dell refilled their cups and stopped to talk. With a hand on one hip, she said,
No, I never knew him. But my cousin knows his first wife. He had at least 2, and according to the first one, Seth had some land and money. She said he laid low, kept secrets, and didn't trust anybody. Also said he was a nasty son of a bitch, but then they always say that after the divorce.
You ought to know, Prather added.
I do know, old boy. I know so much more than you.
Is there a last will and testament? Jake asked. Probate work was not his favorite, but a sizable estate usually meant a decent fee for someone in town. It was all paper shuffling with a couple of court appearances, nothing difficult and not too tedious. Jake knew that by 9 a.m., the lawyers in town would be slinking around, trying to find out who wrote Seth Hubbard's last will.
Don't know yet, Prather said.
Wills ain't public record, are they, Jake?
Asked Bill West, an electrician at the shoe factory north of town. Not until you die. You can change your will at the last minute, so it would be useless to record it. Plus, you might not want the world to know what's in your will until you're dead. Once that happens and once the will is probated, then it's filed in court and becomes public. Jake looked around as he spoke and counted at least 3 men he had prepared wills for. He made them short, quick and cheap, and this was well known in town. It kept the traffic moving.
When does probate start? Bill West asked.
There's no time limit. Usually the surviving spouse or children of the deceased will find the will, take it to a lawyer, and a month or so after the funeral, they'll go to court and start the process.
What if there's no will?
That's a lawyer's dream, Jake said with a laugh. It's a mess. If Mr. Hubbard died with no will and left behind a couple of ex-wives,
maybe some adult children, maybe some grandchildren, who knows? Then they'd probably spend the next 5 years fighting over his property, assuming, of course, he does have assets.
Oh, he's got 'em, Dell said from across the cafe, her radar as always on high alert. If you coughed, she quizzed you about your health. If you sneezed, she hustled over with a tissue. If you were uncharacteristically quiet, she might pry into your home life or your job. If you tried to whisper, she would be standing at your table, refilling cups of coffee, regardless of how full they happened to be. She missed nothing, remembered everything, and never failed to remind her boys of something they'd said to the contrary 3 years earlier.
Marshall Prather rolled his eyes at Jake as if to say, "She's nuts." But he wisely said nothing. Instead, he finished off his pancakes and had to leave. Jake was not far behind. He paid his check at 6:40 and left the coffee shop hugging Dell on the way out and choking on the fumes of her cheap perfume. The sky was orange in the east as dawn unfolded. Yesterday's rain was gone, and the air was clear and cool. As always, Jake headed east, away from his office, and at a brisk pace, as if he were late for an important meeting. The truth was that he had no important meetings that day, just a couple of routine office visits with people in trouble. Jake took his morning stroll around the Clanton Square, passing banks and insurance agencies and realty offices, shops and cafes, all tucked neatly together, all closed at this early hour. With a few exceptions, the buildings were two-story red brick with wrought iron laced terraces overhanging the sidewalks that ran in a perfect square around the courthouse and its lawn. Clanton wasn't exactly prospering, but it wasn't dying either, like so many small towns in the rural South. The 1980 census put the population at just over 8,000, four times that much for the entire county, and the numbers were expected to increase slightly after the next headcount. There were no empty storefronts, nothing boarded up, no for lease signs hanging sadly in the windows. He was from Caraway, a small town of 2,500, 18 miles west of Clanton, and Main Street there was decaying as merchants retired, cafes closed, and the lawyers gradually packed their books and moved to the county seat. There were now 26 around the Clanton Square, and the number was growing, the competition steadily choking itself. How many more can we stand? Jake often asked himself. He relished walking past the other law offices and gazing at their locked doors and dark reception rooms. It was a victory lap of sorts. In his smugness, he was ready to tackle the day, while his competition was still asleep. He walked past the office of Harry Rex Vonner, perhaps his closest friend in the bar, and a warrior who rarely arrived before 9, often with a reception filled with edgy divorce clients. Harry Rex had been through several wives and knew a chaotic home life, and for this reason he preferred to work late into the night. Jake walked past the hated Sullivan firm, home of the largest collection of lawyers in the county. 9 at last count. 9 complete assholes Jake tried to avoid, but this was partly out of envy. Sullivan had the banks and insurance companies, and its lawyers earned more than all the rest. He walked past the troubled and padlocked office of an old pal named Max Stafford, unseen and unheard from now for 8 months, after apparently fleeing in the middle of the night with money belonging to his clients. His wife and 2 daughters were still waiting, as was an indictment. Secretly, Jake hoped Mac was on a beach somewhere, sipping rum drinks and never coming back. He'd been an unhappy man in an unhappy marriage. "Keep running, Mac," Jake said each morning as he touched the padlock without breaking stride. He passed the offices of the Ford County Times, the tea shop, which was only now coming to life, a haberdashery where he bought his suits on sale, a black-owned cafe called Claude's where he ate every Friday with the other white liberals in town, an antique store owned by a crook Jake had sued twice,
A bank still holding the second mortgage on his home and tied up in the same lawsuit, and a county office building where the new district attorney worked when he was in town. The old one, Rufus Buckley, was gone, banished last year by the voters and permanently retired from elective office, or at least Jake and many others hoped so. He and Buckley had almost choked each other during the Haley trial, and the hatred was still intense. Now the ex-DA was back in his hometown of Smithfield in Polk County, where he was licking his wounds and scrambling to make a living on a main street crammed with other law offices. The loop was over, and Jake unlocked the front door to his own office, which was generally considered to be the finest in town. The building, along with many others on the square, had been built by the Wilbanks family 100 years earlier, and for almost that long, a Wilbanks had practiced law there. The streak ended when Lucian, the last remaining Wilbanks, and no doubt the craziest, had been disbarred. He had just hired Jake, fresh out of law school and full of ideals. Lucian wanted to corrupt him, but before he had the chance, the State Bar Association yanked his license for the last time. With Lucian gone and no other Wilbanks around, Jake inherited a magnificent suite of offices. He used only 5 of the 10 rooms available. There was a large reception area downstairs where the current secretary did her work and greeted clients. Above it, in a splendid room 30 feet by 30, Jake spent his days behind a massive oak desk that had been used by Lucian, his father, and grandfather. When he was bored, a common occurrence, he walked to the double French doors, opened them, and stepped onto the terrace, where he had a fine view of the courthouse and the square. At 7 a.m. on schedule, he sat behind his desk and took a sip of coffee. He looked at his calendar for the day and admitted to himself that it did not look promising or profitable. Chapter 3. The current secretary was a 31-year-old mother of 4 who had been hired by Jake only because he could find no one more suitable. When she began 5 months earlier, he had been desperate, and she had been available. She went by Roxy, and on the plus side, Roxy showed up for work each morning around 8:30, or a few minutes thereafter, and did a somewhat passable job of answering the phone, greeting the clients, chasing away the riffraff, typing, filing, and keeping her turf somewhat organized. On the negative and heavier side of the ledger, Roxy had little interest in the job, viewed it as only temporary until something better came along, smoked on the back porch and smelled like it, nagged about the low salary, made vague but loaded comments as to how she thought all lawyers were rich, and in general, was an unpleasant person to be around. She was from Indiana, had been dragged south in an army marriage, and like many from the North, had little patience with the culture around her. She'd had a superior upbringing and was now living in a backward place. Though Jake did not inquire, he strongly suspected her marriage was less than fulfilling. Her husband had lost his job due to dereliction. She wanted Jake to sue on his behalf, but Jake declined. And this was still festering. Plus, there was about $50 missing from petty cash, and Jake suspected the worst. He would have to fire her, something he hated to think about. Each morning during his quiet time, he said his daily prayer and asked God to give him the patience to coexist with this latest woman in his life. There had been so many. He had hired young ones because they were more plentiful and worked cheaper. The better of those got married and pregnant and wanted 6 months off. The bad ones flirted, wore tight miniskirts, and made suggestive comments. One threatened a bogus action for sexual harassment when Jake fired her, but she was arrested for bad checks and went away. He had hired more mature women to negate any physical temptation, but as a rule, they had been bossy, maternal, menopausal, and they had more doctor's appointments, as well as aches and pains to talk about and funerals to attend. For decades, the place had been ruled by Ethel Twitty, a legendary presence who ran the Wilbanks firm in its heyday. For over 40 years, Ethel had kept the lawyers in line, terrified the other secretaries, and fought with the younger associates, none of whom lasted more than a year or two. But Ethel was now retired, forced out by Jake during the Haley Circus. Her husband had been beaten by thugs, probably Klansmen, though the case was unsolved and its investigation going nowhere. Jake had been thrilled when she left. Now, though, he almost missed her. At precisely 8:30, he was downstairs in the kitchen, pouring more coffee, then puttering around a storage room as if searching for an old file. When Roxy eased through the rear door at 8:39, Jake was standing by her desk, flipping through the pages of a document, waiting, establishing the fact that she was, once again, late for work. That she had four young children, an unemployed and unhappy husband, a job she didn't like with a salary she deemed meager, and a host of other problems, all this mattered little to Jake. If he liked her, he could find some sympathy. But as the weeks passed, he liked her less and less. He was building a file, handing out silent demerits, piling on the points so that when he sat her down for the dreaded talk, he would have his facts. Jake despised being in the position of plotting to unload an undesirable secretary. "Good morning, Roxy," he said, glancing at his wristwatch.
"Hello. Sorry I'm late. Had to take the kids to school."
He was sick of the lying, too, however small it was. Her unemployed husband hauled the kids to school and back. Carla had verified this. "Uh-huh," Jake mumbled as he picked up a stack of envelopes she had just placed on her desk. He grabbed the mail before she could open it and shuffled through it in search of something interesting. It was the usual pile of junk mail and lawyerly crap, letters from other firms, one from a judge's office, thick envelopes with copies of briefs, motions, pleadings, and so on. He did not open these. That job belonged to the secretary.
"Looking for something?"
she asked as she dropped her purse and bag and began settling in. "No." Typically, she looked pretty rough. No makeup and a mess of hair. She hurried off to the restroom to put on her face and improve her looks, a project that often took 15 minutes. More silent demerits. At the bottom of the stack, on the very last regular-sized envelope of the day, Jake glanced at his name written in blue ink, cursive. The return address stunned him, and he almost dropped everything. He tossed the other mail into the middle of her desk, then hurried up the stairs to his office. He locked his door. He sat down at a roll top in one corner, under a portrait of William Faulkner that had been purchased by Mr. John Wilbanks, Lucian's father, and inspected the envelope. Generic, plain, white, letter-sized, cheap paper, probably purchased in a box of 100 for $5, adorned with a 25-cent stamp honoring an astronaut, and thick enough to contain several sheets of paper. It was addressed to him, the Honorable Jake Brigance, attorney at law, 146 Washington Street, Clanton, Mississippi. No zip code. The return address was Seth Hubbard, P.O. Box 277, Palmyra, Mississippi, 38664. The envelope had been stamped with a postmark on October 1, 1988, the previous Saturday, at the Clanton Post Office. Jake took a deep breath and deliberately considered the scenario. If the coffee shop gossip could be believed, and Jake had no reason to doubt it, not at that moment anyway, Seth Hubbard had hung himself less than 24 hours earlier, on Sunday afternoon. It was now 8:45 Monday morning. For the letter to be postmarked in Clanton last Saturday, Seth Hubbard, or someone acting on his behalf, dropped the letter into the local delivery slot inside the Clanton post office either late Friday or Saturday before noon when the facility closed. Only local mail was postmarked in Clanton. All other was trucked to a regional center in Tupelo, sorted, marked, then dispersed. Jake found a pair of scissors and meticulously cut a thin ribbon of paper from one end of the envelope, the end opposite the return address, close to the stamp, but far enough away to preserve everything. There was the possibility he was holding evidence. He would copy everything later. He squeezed the envelope slightly and shook it until the folded papers fell out. He was aware of an increased heart rate as he carefully unfolded the sheets. Three of them, all plain white, nothing fancy, no letterhead. He pressed the creases and laid the papers flat on the desk. Then he picked up the top one. In blue ink and in a neat cursive hand, impressive for a man, the author wrote, "Dear Mr. Brigance, to my knowledge we have never met, nor will we. By the time you read this, I will be dead, and that awful town you live in will be buzzing with its usual gossip. I have taken my own life, but only because my death by lung cancer is imminent. The doctors have given me only weeks to live, and I'm tired of the pain. I'm tired of a lot of things. If you smoke cigarettes, take the advice of a dead man and stop immediately. I chose you because you have the reputation of being honest, and I admired your courage during the trial of Carl Lee Haley. I strongly suspect you are a man of tolerance, something sadly missing in this part of the world. I despise lawyers, especially those in Clanton. I will not name names at this point in my life, but I will die with a tremendous amount of unresolved ill will aimed at various members of your profession. Vultures, bloodsuckers. Enclosed herein, you will find my last will and testament, every word written by me and signed and dated by me. I've checked the law of Mississippi and am satisfied that it is a proper holographic will, thus entitled to full enforcement under the law. No one witnessed me signing this will because, as you know, witnesses are not required for holographic wills. A year ago, I signed a thicker version in the offices of the Rush Law Firm in Tupelo, but I have renounced that document. This one is likely to start some trouble, and that's why I want you as the attorney for my estate. I want this will defended at all costs, and I know you can do it. I specifically cut out my two adult children, their children, and my two ex-wives. These are not nice people, and they will fight. So get ready. My estate is substantial. They have no idea of its size, and when this is made known, they will attack. Fight them, Mr. Brigance, to the bitter end. We must prevail. With my suicide note, I left instructions for my funeral and burial. Do not mention my last will and testament until after the funeral. I want my family to be forced to go through all the rituals of mourning before they realize they get nothing. Watch them fake it. They're very good at it. They have no love for me. I thank you in advance for your zealous representation. It will not be easy. I am comforted in knowing I will not be there to suffer through such an agonizing ordeal. Sincerely, Seth Hubbard, October 1st, 1988. Jake was too nervous to read the will. He took a deep breath, stood, walked around the office, opened the French doors to the terrace, and had the morning's first good look at the courthouse and the square, then returned to the roll top. He read the letter again. It would be used as evidence to establish Seth Hubbard's testamentary capacity, and for a moment Jake was paralyzed with indecision. He wiped his hands on his pants. Should he leave the letter, the envelope, and the other sheets of paper exactly where they were and run fetch Ozzy? Should he call a judge? No. The letter was mailed to him, in confidence, and he had every right to examine its contents. Still, he felt as though he was handling a ticking bomb. Slowly he moved the letter aside and stared at the next sheet of paper. With a laboring heart and trembling hands, he looked at the blue ink and knew full well that these words would consume the next year of his life, or maybe two. It read, Last Will and Testament of Henry Seth Hubbard. I, Seth Hubbard, being 71 years old and of good mind but decaying body, do hereby make this my last will and testament. 1. I am a resident of the state of Mississippi. My legal address is 4498 Simpson Road, Palmyra, Ford County, Mississippi. 2. I renounce all previous wills signed by me, specifically one dated September 7, 1987, and prepared by Mr. Lewis McGuire of the Rush Law Firm in Tupelo, Mississippi. And that will specifically renounced one I signed in March of 1985. 3. This is intended to be a holographic will, with every word written by me, in my handwriting, with no help from anyone. It is signed and dated by me. I prepared it alone, in my office, on this day, October 1st, 1988. 4. I am of clear mind and have full testamentary capacity. No one is exerting or attempting to exert influence over me. 5. I appoint as executor of my estate Russell Amberg of 762 Ember Street, Temple, Mississippi. Mr. Amberg was vice president of my holding company and has a working knowledge of my assets and liabilities. I direct Mr. Amberg to retain the services of Mr. Jake Brigance, attorney at law in Clanton, Mississippi, to provide all necessary representation. It is my directive that no other lawyer in Ford County touch my estate or earn a penny from its probate. 6. I have 2 children, Herschel Hubbard and Ramona Hubbard Defoe, and they have children, though I don't know how many because I haven't seen them in some time. I specifically exclude both of my children and all of my grandchildren from any inheritance under my estate. They get nothing. I do not know the precise legal language necessary to cut out a person from an inheritance, but my intention here is to completely prohibit them, my children and grandchildren, from getting anything from me. If they contest this will and lose, it is my desire that they pay all attorney's fees and court costs incurred as a result of their greed. 7. I have 2 ex-wives who I will not name. Since they got virtually everything in the divorces, they get nothing more here. I specifically exclude them. May they perish in pain, like me. 8. I give, devise, transfer, leave behind, whatever the hell it takes, 90% of my estate to my friend, Letty Lang, as thanks for her dedicated service in friendship to me during these past few years. Her full name is Letitia Dolores Tabor Lang, and her address is 1488 Montrose Road, Box Hill, Mississippi. 9. I give, devise, etc., 5% of my estate to my brother, Ansel F. Hubbard, if he's still alive. I have not heard from Ansel in many years, though I have thought of him often. He was a lost boy who deserved better. As children, He and I witnessed something no human should ever see. And Ansel was forever traumatized. If he's dead by now, his 5% share remains in my estate. 10. I give, devise, etc., 5% of my estate to the Irish Road Christian Church. 11. I direct my executor to sell my house, land, real property, personal property, and lumberyard near Palmyra for market value as soon as practical, and place the proceeds into my estate. Seth Hubbard, October 1st, 1988. The signature was small and neat and quite legible. Jake wiped his hands again on his pants and reread the will. It covered 2 pages, and the handwriting was in near perfect lines, as though Seth had meticulously used a straight edge of some variety. A dozen questions clamored for attention, with the most obvious being, who in the world is Letty Lang? A close second was, what exactly did she do to deserve 90%? Then, how big is the estate? If it is indeed sizable, how much will be eaten up in death taxes? This question was quickly followed with, how much might the attorney's fees run? But before he got greedy, Jake took another walk around the office, his head spinning and his adrenaline rising. What a wondrous legal brawl. With money on the line, there was little doubt Seth's family would lawyer up and attack the last will with a fury. Though Jake had never handled a full-blown will contest, he knew such cases were tried in chancery court and often before juries. It was rare for a dead person in Ford County to leave much behind, but occasionally someone with a measure of wealth would pass on without proper estate planning or with a suspicious will. These occasions were a bonanza to the local bar as the lawyers raged in and out of court and the assets evaporated in legal fees. He gently placed the envelope and the 3 sheets of paper into a file and carried it downstairs to Roxy's desk. By now her looks had improved somewhat, and she was opening the mail. "Read this," he said, and slowly. She did as he instructed, and when she finished, she said, "Wow, great way to start the week." "Not so for old Seth," Jake said. "Please note that this arrived in the mail this morning, October 3rd.
"So noted. Why?"
"The timing could be crucial one day in court, Saturday, Sunday, Monday."
"I'm going to be a witness?"
"Maybe, maybe not. But we're just taking precautions, okay?"
"You're the lawyer."
Jake ran 4 copies of the envelope, the letter, and the will. He gave Roxy a copy to enter into the firm's newest case file, and he tucked 2 away in a locked drawer in his desk. He waited until 9 a.m. and left the office with the original and 1 copy. He told Roxy he was headed for the courthouse. He walked next door to Security Bank, where he placed the original in his firm's lockbox. Ozzie Wall's office was at the county jail, 2 blocks off the square, in a low-slung concrete bunker built on the cheap a decade earlier. A tumor-like appendage had been added later to house the sheriff and his staff and deputies, and the place was crammed with cheap desks, folding chairs, and stained carpet fraying at the baseboards. Monday mornings were usually hectic as the weekend's fun and games were tidied up. Angry wives arrived to bail their hungover husbands out of jail. Other wives stormed in to sign papers to get their husbands thrown into jail. Frightened parents waited for details of the drug bust that caught their kids. The phones rang more than usual and often went unanswered. Deputies milled about, choking down donuts and sipping strong coffee. Add to the usual frenzy the bizarre suicide of a mysterious man, and the cluttered outer office was especially busy that Monday morning. In the rear of the appendage, down a short hallway, there was a thick door covered in white, hand-painted lettering that read, "Ozzie Walls, High Sheriff, Ford County." The door was closed. The sheriff was in early on Monday and on the phone. The caller was an emotional woman from Memphis whose child had been caught driving a pickup truck that was hauling, among other things, a sizable quantity of marijuana. This had happened the previous Saturday night near Lake Chitula in an area of a state park where illicit behavior was known to be common. The child was innocent, of course, and the mother was eager to drive down and retrieve him from Ozzie's jail. "Not so fast," Ozzie cautioned. There was a knock at his door. He covered the receiver and said,
"Yes?"
The door opened a few inches, and Jake Brigant stuck his head through the crack. Ozzie smiled immediately and waved him in. Jake closed the door behind himself and eased into a chair. Ozzie was explaining that even though the kid was 17, he had been caught with 3 pounds of pot, thus he could not be released on bond until a judge said so. As the mother railed, Ozzie frowned and moved the receiver a few inches from his ear. He shook his head, smiled again. Same old crap. Jake had heard it too, many times. Ozzie listened some more, promised to do what he could, which was obviously not much, and finally got off the phone. He half stood, shook Jake's hand, said,
"Good morning, counselor."
"Morning to you, Ozzie." They chatted about this and that and finally got around to football. Ozzie had played briefly for the Rams before blowing out a knee, and he still followed the team religiously. Jake was a Saints fan, like the majority of Mississippians, so there was little to talk about. The entire wall behind Ozzie was covered with football memorabilia, photos, awards, plaques, trophies. He had been an All-American at Alcorn State in the mid-1970s and evidently had been meticulous about preserving his memories. On another day, another time, preferably with more of an audience, say around the courtroom in a recess when other lawyers were listening, Ozzie might be tempted to tell the story of the night he broke Jake's leg. Jake had been a skinny sophomore quarterback playing for Caraway, a much smaller school that for some reason kept the tradition of getting stomped each year in the season finale against Clanton. Billed as a backyard brawl, the game was never close. Ozzie, the star tackle, had terrorized the Caraway offense for 3 quarters, and late in the fourth, he rushed hard, 3rd and long. The fullback, already wounded and frightened, ignored Ozzie, who crushed Jake as he desperately tried to scramble. Ozzie had always claimed he heard the fibula snap. In Jake's version, he heard nothing but Ozzie's growling and snarling as he pounced for the kill. Regardless of the version, the story managed to get retold at least once a year. It was Monday morning, though, and the phones were ringing, and both men were busy. It was obvious Jake was there for a reason. "I think I've been hired by Mr. Seth Hubbard," he said. Ozzie narrowed his eyes and studied his friend.
"His hiring days are over. They got him down at McGoggles on the slab."
"Did you cut him down?"
"Let's say we lowered him to the ground."
Ozzie reached for a file, opened it, and took out 3 8x10 color photos. He slid them across his desk, and Jake picked them up. Front, back, right side, all the same image of Seth, sad and dead, hanging in the rain. Jake was shocked for a second, but didn't show it. He studied the grotesque face and tried to place him. "I never met the man," he mumbled. "Who found him?"
"One of his workers. Looks like Mr. Hubbard planned it all."
"Oh, yes." Jake reached into a coat pocket, pulled out the copies, and slid them over to Ozzie. "This arrived in the morning's mail, hot off the press. The first page is a letter to me. The second and third pages purport to be his last will and testament." Ozzie lifted the letter and read it slowly. Showing no expression, He read the will. When he finished, he dropped it on the desk and rubbed his eyes.
Wow,
he managed to say.
Is this thing legal, Jake?
On its face, yes. But I'm sure the family will attack it.
Attack it how?
They'll make all sorts of claims. The old guy was out of his mind. This woman exerted undue influence over him and convinced him to change his will. Believe me, if money's at stake, they'll unload both barrels.
This woman,
Ozzy repeated, then smiled and began to slowly shake his head. You know her?
Oh, yeah.
Black or white?
Black.
Jake suspected this and was not at all surprised nor disappointed. Rather, at that moment, he began to feel the early rumblings of excitement. A white man and his money. A last-minute will leaving it all to a black woman he was obviously quite fond of. A bitter will dispute played out before a jury, with Jake in the middle of it all. How well do you know her? Jake asked. It was well known that Ozzy knew every black person in Ford County, those registered to vote and those still lagging, those who owned land and those who were on welfare, those who had jobs and those who avoided work, those who saved money and those who broke into houses, those who went to church every Sunday, and those who lived in honky-tonks.
I know her, he said, careful as always. She lives out from Box Hill in an area called Little Delta.
Jake nodded, said, I've driven through it.
In the boondocks, all black. She's married to a man named Simeon Lang, pretty much of a deadbeat who comes and goes, off and on the wagon.
I've never met any Langs.
You don't want to meet this one. When he's sober, I think he drives a truck and runs a bulldozer. I know he worked offshore once or twice. Unstable. 4 or 5 kids, 1 boy in prison. I think there's a girl in the army. Letty's about 45, I'd guess. She's a Tabor, and there aren't many of them around. He's a Lang, and the woods are full of Langs, unfortunately. I did not know she was working for Seth Hubbard.
Did you know Hubbard?
Somewhat. He gave me $25,000 under the table, cash, for both of my campaigns. Wanted nothing in return. In fact, he almost avoided me my first 4 years. I saw him last summer when I was up for re-election, and he gave me another envelope.
You took the cash?
I don't like your tone, Jake,
Ozzy said with a smile.
Yes, I took the cash, because I wanted to win. Plus, my opponents were taking cash. Politics is a tough business round here.
Fine with me. How much money did the old man have?
Well, he says it's substantial. Personally, I don't know. It's always been a mystery. The rumor has been that he lost everything in a bad divorce. Harry Rex cleaned him out, and because of that, he's kept his business buried under a rock.
Smart man.
He owns some land and has always dabbled in timber. Beyond that, I don't know.
What about his 2 adult children?
I talked to Herschel Hubbard around 5 yesterday afternoon. Broke the bad news. He lives in Memphis, but I didn't get much information. He said he would call his sister Ramona and they would hustle on over. Seth left a sheet of paper with some instructions on how he wanted to be handled. Funeral tomorrow at 4 p.m. at church, then a burial.
Ozzy paused and reread the letter.
Seems kind of cruel, doesn't it, Jake? Seth wants his family to suffer through a proper mourning before they know he screwed them in his will.
Jake chuckled and said, Oh, I think it's beautiful. You want to go to the funeral?
Only if you go, you're on.
They sat in silence for a moment, listening to the voices outside, to the ringing of the phones, and they both knew they had things to do. But there were so many questions, so much high drama just around the corner. I wonder what those boys saw, Jake said, Seth and his brother. Ozzy shook his head, no clue. He glanced at the will and said,
Ansel F. Hubbard. I can try and find him if you want. Run his name through the network. See if he's got a record anywhere.
Do that. Thanks. After another heavy pause, Ozzie said,
Jake, I have a lot on my plate this morning.
Jake jumped to his feet and said,
Me too.
Thanks.
I'll call later.
Chapter 4 The drive from central Memphis to Ford County was only an hour, but for Herschel Hubbard, it was always a lonesome journey that seemed to kill a day. It was an unwelcome excursion into his past, and for many reasons, he made it only when necessary, which wasn't very often. He'd left home at 18, kicking the dirt off his shoes and vowing to avoid the place whenever possible. He had been an innocent casualty in a war between his parents, and when they finally split, he sided with his mother and fled the county and his father. 28 years later, he found it difficult to believe the old man was finally dead. There had been efforts at reconciliation, usually at Herschel's urging, and Seth, to his credit, had hung on for a while and tried to tolerate his son and his grandkids. But a second wife and a second bad marriage had intervened and complicated matters. For the past decade, Seth had cared for nothing but his work. He called on most birthdays and sent a Christmas card once every 5 years, but that was the extent of his efforts at fatherhood. The more he worked, the more he looked down on his son's career, and this was a major cause of their tension. Herschel owned a college bar near the campus of Memphis State. As bars go, it was popular and busy. He paid his bills and hid some cash. Like father, like son, he was still grappling with the aftershocks of his own nasty divorce, one won decidedly by his ex, who got the two kids and virtually all the money. For 4 years now, Herschel had been forced to live with his mother in an old declining house in central Memphis, along with a bunch of cats and the occasional freeloading bum his mother took in. She, too, had been scarred by an unpleasant life with Seth, and was, as they say, off her rocker. He crossed the Ford County line, and his mood grew even darker. He was driving a sports car, a little Datsun he had bought secondhand primarily because his late father hated Japanese cars, hated all things Japanese, really. Seth had lost a cousin in World War II at the hands of his Japanese captors and relished wallowing in his well-earned bigotry.